there's a film in that.
Interview. It's an interview.
There's a film in that.
Interview.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn if there's a film in that.
So, yeah, so after managing to deliver our first interview last week with the lovely Pete Appleyard, who quite a few people said to me it was you know, really informative and helpful. So thanks again, Pete.
Thank you, Pete.
We've managed to follow up this week with...
Mr. Sacha Bennett, British writer and film director, and the introducer of me to Lowenbrow Beer once. Got very hung, very drunk. But he has some amazing credits and writing credits under his name, particularly Outside Better with Bob Hoskins, along with We Still Kill the Old Way. Get Lucky, there's a few on here actually I recommend you watching of his, and obviously I'm going to big him up. He's a lovely chap, and has some sage advice on writing for us.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Absolute pleasure.
So what is your process for sitting down and writing, say, like a new idea?
This isn't the answer you probably want, but it depends. It changes from script to script. It depends on what's required. I always have a slight lethargy about starting a script unless I know that there's a market, as it were, for it. So if I have a meeting and they go, what we're really looking for is Blade Runner meets La La Land, then I'll go, great, well, Ryan Gosling's definitely in it for a start. But then I'll go, okay, so, all right, there's a chance that this might actually get made. I seem to have lost that burning hunger that I had when I was younger of just going, I know this is a great idea, and I'll just sit down and write the bloody thing over a weekend.
Yeah. What are the differences, do you think, in being a writer-director versus a writer when working on a project?
So when you're exclusively the writer and you know that you're only writing the screenplay and you're handing it over to someone who is possibly more talented than you, possibly less talented, but whatever, you're just the wordsmith, you have to completely take off that director hat. And it's tricky because you start... Certainly if you like the project, you know, if you're just a gun for hire and you're just getting paid and it is what it is, and you've been told literally what scenes they want and what they want changed or whatever it might be, you almost don't care. You always try and obviously put the passion into the writing and make it as good as it can be. Mm. But you stop at that. You don't carry on the process, which is like, oh, and what if, and then great, oh, and if it was a drone shot, then we could actually, you know, transition that scene into the next scene and blah, because when you are a writer director, you are thinking about those things as well.
Yeah.
They do feed into the actual writing and the screenplay. And also likewise, when you are also the writer director, you know, it's also going to be your problem to achieve that on the day.
Mm.
So you will be kind of going, oh God, I know I've said that the guy's going to be in a car talking on his mobile phone, driving through Soho, but that is going to be an absolute bitch to film. Why not just have the guy sat on a rooftop looking over London? Because that will be easier to film. It will be more epic looking. And I can save that money that would have been on a low loader and drug permissions in Soho and people staring through the window and traffic and all that other nonsense. I can put all that money towards the big explosion at the end or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're the writer and someone is going, yeah, so he's a man of Soho. We definitely need him. He's a man about town and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Then kind of going, well, that's your problem. Then I'll certainly write interior car Soho London rush hour, and away you go,
because
you parked that at the door. And so the other thing about sort of just being a writer for hire is that you know even if you read it back and you go, man, that's a brilliant piece of writing, I'm so pleased with myself. You also have to have a little bulletproof vest on, because you know, certainly with experience, you don't know on the first couple of jobs, and you're like, well, why is there so much red ink on this script? but when you are writer directing and you are pleased with it, you know, it's much easier, because you just go, brilliant, I'm away. And then, of course, you've got to convince the producers and financiers, and then eventually the actors. But if you're just the writer, you've got to have slightly thicker skin, because the director will come in and, like I say, sort of strike through stuff. No, I don't want the lead actress having any dialogue. I just want her to look beautiful. I don't want to cast someone that can act, whatever it might be. I've had these conversations. God. And you just sit there over your latte and you nod and you make your notes and you go, well, look, it's not my film. It's my name on the screenplay, so I'll make the dialogue and the story as good as it can be, but these key decisions aren't mine. They can't be mine.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big problem with writers. They always, certainly early day writers as well, they always cling on to this notion that because they've written it, they are God.
Mm.
And unfortunately, that may well work in theatre, but when it comes to film, rightly or wrongly, the director is God.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
but he's a god with a lawyer above him, which is a producer, kind of going, no, yes, no, yes. But, writers on films have to accept that the director runs the show and he has it how he wants to have it. And that's normally because they know what they're doing and they're the ones that have got to film it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, they're complete bloody idiots and they don't know what they're doing and they'll completely butcher a wonderful screenplay and turn it into a piece of trash, at which point the writer should absolutely remove their name.
I didn't write this, someone made me do it.
Well, this is it, because as the writer you are pretty powerless.
Yeah.
And when it comes to shooting, when the writer says, well, I've been there myself on both sides as the director and indeed as a writer, oh, can I do a set visit? It's like, oh, Jesus Christ, that's the last thing we need, is the writer on set kind of going, hang on a minute, you didn't say that line quite. Why have you changed that word? What do you mean the actor's written his own monologue?
I don't remember them being like that at all. Yeah, that's, God, that, I mean, that's, he's got one leg. He's cut his own leg off. this kind of leads into this as well. I mean, let's assume then that you've, on a character you've had, or even, going forward, anything that you are currently writing, knowing that you're directing, how do you develop your characters both as a writer and then working with your characters that you've created with the actors as well? Do you give them notes and wait for them to have ideas, or is it all like kind of rehearsal work, or how does that fare when you're actually developing the characters, do you think?
Quite a lot of my work has been based on IP, as they call it now, intellectual property. So either a book or real life people or, an existing idea or a sequel or whatever it might be. So you kind of already got sort of a framework there, which is good because it means you can get into it quicker, but it's also bad because it means you are contained and you have parameters. But I'm a massive fan of Aaron Sorkin, who did The West Wing and Social Network, obviously. What I love about his work, and, sometimes it can be leveled at him as an argument against him being a genius writer, of which I think he is. He absolutely embraces dialogue, and he just populates his screenplays with such beautiful, juicy lines and bitchy one-liners and comebacks and little seeds he puts in at the beginning of the screenplay that pay off at the end, and you're like, oh my god, that was just extraordinary. How that happened. It was so clever. The flip is, the argument is, does everyone actually talk like that? No. You probably know one maybe two people in your life that is so good at words and smart and witty and throws out like interesting dialogue in a conversation, a dinner party, pub, whatever. On the whole, most people, are kind of a one or two line kind of person, and it's just information being handed over. Mm. How you doing? Yeah, fine. Yeah. What's going on? Oh, the dog died, and load of crap at work at the moment, and blah, blah. That's actually how people talk.
Yeah.
Which, if you put that in a movie, I know some filmmakers embrace that, the kitchen sink drama sort of gang, but it's although it's real, it doesn't make a movie.
Mm.
What you embrace, and for instance, again, this is Aaron Sorkin, is Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise in a courtroom, and Cruise is going, "You can't handle the truth." You know, no one says that, and a lawyer wouldn't say that in a courtroom.
Yeah,
and yet it's a brilliant piece of cinema. You know, you come to my daughter's wedding, and you're asking me a favor. Again, people don't talk like that. Yeah. An 80 gangster wouldn't. If it's his daughter's wedding, he's out there dancing with her, and he's happy. But of course, that doesn't move the plot forward, and it doesn't make a brilliant start to a wonderful film. So, I'm a massive believer and apostle of Sorkin, and just using dialogue as a way of moving the story forward, giving out information, but hopefully disguising it so it's not exposition or basal exposition, as Austin Powers very brilliantly put.
Amazing.
A great piece of dialogue will move the story forward, tell you something about the character, give you information you need that will probably pay off later. And ideally, for me, I always try and have something funny in there, you know, whether it be sharp wit or whether it be just a sort of an out-and-out joke. Because the one thing I've learned is a very quick way to get the audience on side with a character is if that character says something funny or does something funny, the audience instantly like them.
And
sometimes it's tripped me up a little bit. You know, I've got a film for Universal coming out soon called Tango One, which is based on a book, and there's a Colombian businessman, obviously in a certain industry, who in the book was an absolute and utter, you know, I won't say the word. And I kept falling in love with this character. So as I was adapting the book, I was dispensing with Stephen Levers' dialogue, not because it was bad. I was just going, this guy's got to be big. He's got to have cojones. He's got to be larger than life. You know, everything's wonderful for him, and he can't understand this situation he's in with our hero. So I just kept putting one-liners in, and just this wonderful chemistry he had with one of his henchmen, which was kind of a... you know, the two of them having bants, you know, literally there was a scene where someone gets a Colombian necktie and seconds later these two are talking and the audience laugh, even though they've just done this to another human being. The audience are still going, they're funny, I really like these guys. And you know, it's when you get it right, when you get that moment. And it happened in We Still Kill the Old Way as well, where Chris Ellison, who played Roy in the film, he drills into a teenage boy's shins, which in any other movie, you're going, oh my God, what the hell is wrong with this guy? And oh, that poor teenager, because he's strapped into a chair. But what happens, certainly the screenings I've had the luck to sort of be sat in with, the audience start clapping. They don't even laugh, they start clapping. They actually are going, yes, that teenager deserves it. And that's because of everything that came before it, where I made that teenager so awful through his dialogue. You know, he's talking about killing a war veteran and laughing at one of their daughters and all the rest of it. So by making him so awful, and yet this guy's got an electric drill and doing it to him, the audience is still on the side of the guy doing the torture.
So
again, that's through dialogue, it's not through anything else. That's through because they went, right, I hate that guy because of what he said, and I love that guy because he had a witty one-liner.
Look at James Bond,
the guy is a killing machine and screws around, and every time he beds a woman she ends up dead in the next scene.
Yeah,
and you're kind of going, yeah, I want to be that guy.
Yeah.
So
it's guns.
So, you know, for me, dialogue is really important in terms of establishing, like I say, story plot points, information about another character, or indeed the character saying it. Because don't forget, in dialogue, they could actually be talking about the other guy, and you're learning from that as well. And then, yeah, like I say, humor is just a wonderful device if you can put it in there.
Yeah,
it doesn't even have to be comedy. Like I say, We Still Kill the Old Way is not a comedy, and yet people laugh more in that movie than they do at a self professed comedy. So you're saying it's not manipulation, but it is, and that's what screenplays are. That's what, as a filmmaker, you are completely manipulating the audience. You are,
okay.
If you're doing it well, you know, obviously if you're doing it badly, then you're not manipulating anyone. But if you are presenting the story and the characters are talking to the audience in that respect, mm-hmm. you're guiding them through the story. And it seems seamless. You're not even aware that, you know, you're going from one scene to the next. Then of course that's manipulation at its highest form.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what storytelling is. You are, you know, you're holding someone's hand and you're going, we're going to go this way, even though the audience might actually want to go right.
Yeah.
But as long as they keep going, I trust you.
Yeah.
And you're guiding them. Then you're manipulating them, but also you've completely got their trust.
Manipulate in the most positive way. You can do in the most, yeah, I like that. How do you approach then directing a script that you haven't written, or have you had to have that? Have you had to do that, or like, or something that you've had to kind of jump on board and carry on, or anything like that? How would you approach it?
Pretty much, and I'm just trying to think. Every script I've done 8 movies now, and every script apart from my first feature. Was a screenplay that was presented to me. And just as a side note, it's always a bit ironic because people, producers and financiers, have read my screenplays and they've gone, this is great, but we found the money for this one, so would you like to do this one? And it's a really frustrating scenario, because actually what has ended up, I'm not going to say all of them, but what has ended up is I'll be presented with a screenplay that is just no good. And I'm like, how on earth have you found the finance on something that just, it doesn't work? Mm. And again, I won't mention names, but there's one screenplay where you could have literally put redacted all the character names, put a black mark, CIA style, throughout the entire script and just blacked out the character names and read the screenplay, and you would have no idea that it was different people talking. It was just a singular voice for whatever was being said, whether it be an 8-year-old boy, a 70-year-old man, a refugee just landing in the country, an Air Force pilot that had, you know, post-stress traumatic disorder or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You'd read all the dialogue and go, this is the same person. I have no idea what's going on. You know, I have no idea who this person is or why they're, seem to be talking to themselves for 95 pages. So therein lies sort of a slight sort of interest in my sort of films after my first one, in so much that I've always been presented with a screenplay that doesn't work for one reason or another, and sometimes to a greater and sometimes to a lesser effect. Some of the screenplays I've completely rewritten from scratch. Some of them I've just molded and changed a few things and added a character just to make sense of it, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But on the whole, and I think the writers would be okay with me saying this, I've pretty much made every screenplay I've directed my own.
Yeah.
Rather than doing what they had originally written. Some of them would definitely argue, you know, the one of the films I wasn't allowed to have a full screenplay credit because the original writer was going, no, absolutely not. He's written enough screenplays. I need this screenplay credit.
Oh my God.
You're in these conversations. We're going, dude, I wrote 95% of this, and you're going to claim for that because you want a gig as a writer on something else. Because that the next producer they work for, of course, is going to go, hang on a minute. I read your last screenplay, and it reads nothing to the one you've just delivered to me. For me, it's a tricky question, because I haven't just taken a screenplay and run with it.
Yeah,
the only one I have done that with is my last film, Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, already, you know, there is there's a voice on there, which is obviously William Shakespeare.
Who's that?
Some loser.
Some old dude.
Some beardy bloke from Soho, isn't it? So already, you know, his fingerprints are obviously all over it.
Mm.
And when it is Shakespeare, as you know, you can't actually, you can cut things, you can abridge, you know, the play that you're doing, you can kind of change the setting and the era or what have you. But you, unless you're just like I did with my Othello script, if you completely make it modern language and just put, if you're just telling the story, that's one thing. But what you can't do is start trying to write like Shakespeare's dialogue, because that's just going to be horrible and a mess. So, Midsummer Night's Dream was adapted by a lovely man called Hal Fowler, who's actually an actor by trade. And so with that, I couldn't really go, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I did some tickles, as I call them, which is kind of like, let's just turn that into this, because I know that's going to be impossible to film.
Okay. So
go on.
I was going to say, it's going back to that thing, isn't it, of going, okay, it's the practicalities of directing with the imagination of writing, is how you blend those together and still come up with a compelling story, isn't it, I guess?
Most screenwriters have no idea what the budget's going to be. They probably don't know what the budget is even once the film's been made, because, of course, they'll be going, why am I only getting £1,000 when the movie was £100 million? But there's a very small percentage of writers realistically that understand production and budget and what things cost. And it's very easy, like I say, to have a guy on the phone driving through Soho, or to have a football stadium full of people and 30 characters are having conversations with each other, you know, but it's easy to write that. And in fact, you know, a great one is A Night to Remember, the Titanic movie from many, many moons ago. I don't want this to be a plot spoiler, but, the Titanic sinks after it hits an
iceberg. I had a chance to say spoiler alert then as well, gutted.
Do you want to do a post-spoiler alert?
Yeah, that was a post-spoiler alert for anyone who's not picked up a history book in their life.
So in A Night to Remember, the screenplay, it gets to page 48 or whatever it is, and it says, exterior, Atlantic, night. The Titanic hits an iceberg and sinks. Now, that is one line on the script. But it equates, of course, to about half an hour of the movie, which, you know, a page a minute is sort of the guide that people have. So that one line description should have technically been 30 pages long. This happens, then this happens, then the sailor falls in the water, then the funnel snaps, then the seal looks with bewilderment, then blah, whatever it is. But that one line of dialogue, it's just so easy just to type that. You know, the writer just went, well, okay, yeah, hits the iceberg and sinks. Okay, moving on to the next scene. People do. But do you know what I mean? It's easy to write that. And that's what a lot of writers, and certainly early days writers, don't appreciate, is how much it takes just to do the most simple of things.
Yeah, we were looking at Rian Johnson's opening to Looper. And it's written incredibly well, but it's literally in full stop. So open cornfield, a man looks at his watch, it ticks. But it does it in such a vivid way, but it's very to the point, where I think a lot of new writers tend to overegg it as well.
They make it flowery and lots of, like, it was a warm autumn's day, the kind of autumn's day that one remembers from childhood.
Yeah.
The apples were going red, the leaves turning bronze. And it's like, yeah, just put exterior woodland.
Yeah, day.
Get on with it.
Yeah. So if you, have you ever had someone else direct your writing? If so, how was that as an experience, do you think?
I do. I've had it a couple of times now. The aforementioned Othello screenplay, which was something I wrote, that was one of those early day passion projects. I actually wrote it just after I'd finished editing Bonded by Blood, which was, blimey, many, many moons ago now. And I was just like, right, okay, I've done a bank job movie for my first film. The second one, which was my first, inverted commas, proper professional gig, and, like, you know, I had all the toys on there. I had cranes, I had, Video Village. I had trucks to the horizon, multiple casts with amazing people, like, you know, good friends like Neil Maskell and Adam Deacon and people. Just like, you know, whatever I suggested, it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
And just an incredible gift for your second movie. And I was like, right, okay, so that's two crime films. I should really try and do something else. Just, I don't want to get in a groove where I'm just known as the crime guy. Which works if you're Martin Scorsese in the 70s in America, but yeah. Doesn't really work in England because, you know, everyone slags off British crime movies. So I was like, right, what do I do? I've always wanted to adapt certain Shakespeare plays and do something interesting with them. So having worked with Adam Deacon on Bonded and Ashley Walters on my first film Tuesday, I was like, okay, let's do a really relevant, hip, interesting, edgy street version of Othello. And I said it in the world of music, and it just worked really well. And I did that thing, as I mentioned earlier, I dispensed with Shakespeare's text. I totally took the story. I kept all the names. He was called Othello. He was, you know, he was called Brabant. He was called Iago. You know, it was all there. But the dialogue, and I borrowed some of Shakespeare's more famous quotes from the play and used them in the music as kind of raps. And I finished it and I was very proud of it. And my wife, who proofreads everything, just said, yeah, okay, this works. And she's a Shakespeare scholar. So I was like, you know, if I can impress her with it, then I know I've done something right.
Do.
So I started sending it out and it got an amazing response. People just go, can we meet? And it got optioned very quickly and for a fairly decent sum. And a year went by and then they wanted to re-option it, still raising money, blah, blah, blah. Then another year went by. And then I was starting, my agent was kind of going, let's let the option lapse. Let's see if there's another home for this. And I had the most extraordinary situation where the producer who I'd been working with on it actually gave my screenplay to another writer who rewrote it. Even though the script was actually out of option. So they didn't own it to do that. So that was one interesting phone call that my agent had with his lawyer. So then they re-optioned it, paid me a lot more money, said, sorry, okay, of course you're going to direct it. And then 6 months later, I got some phone calls and the option had lapsed again. It was after Christmas. The option had lapsed again. And I got two phone calls from two actors who said, can't wait to see it at the casting next week. And I was like, oh, what casting is this? And this was actually around about the same time as We Still Call the Old Way was gearing up. And I was like, these are like two 19-year-old actors I know. So maybe they're going for the gang roles, but they're too big. You know, they were good names. They were too big to sort of turn up for one or two lines of dialogue. And I was like, that's weird. What are you talking about? And they said, oh, this thing, name undisclosed. And I was like, never heard of it. And they said, well, your name's on the screenplay. I was like, really? And they said, yeah, it's like a modern day Othello. I was like, what the hell's going on here? Anyway, agent thunders in. And sure enough, said producer had just given my rewritten screenplay to a completely different director, not bothered to tell me, even though I was contracted to do it. And they started casting and...
Oh, my God.
And away they went. So it went a bit legal. I got paid a lot more than originally I would have. Weirdly, I got paid more to be just to go away than to sort of write and direct from the original contract. So that was a very bitter experience for me. And I've, no one's ever bothered to show me the film, which is a little bit, so that wasn't a great experience. And also what hurt me more, of course, was as I said earlier, this was a project that was going to stop me from being known as the crime guy.
Yeah.
So for it to be taken away from me, my little baby, it was kind of like, oh my God. And it happened again on another project, which actually was a crime film. But I was asked to write this. It was based on a true story about some con artists. It's a film called Plastic and Julian Gilby eventually directed it.
Right.
But a similar thing happened. I was contracted to write the screenplay. You're going to direct it. Everything was going really well. A big studio actually wanted to finance it for worldwide rights, blah, blah, blah. And then, next thing I knew, you're not on the project anymore. The studio backed off because they weren't interested in this new draft that had suddenly appeared out of nowhere. And probably in that film, there's probably about 5% of my... The story's the same because it's a true story.
Yeah.
There's probably about 5% of me in that film. So again, it was weird watching it at the cinema and kind of going, oh, they went right when I'd gone left.
Yeah.
And so I haven't had brilliant experiences of other people directing my work. That said, I've sold screenplays to people that is still in development or finance or what have you, and I'm fine. I'm absolutely happy as Larry. It's just that those two that have been made were ones that I was supposed to direct, and so I have more connection with them.
Yeah. Gosh, that's really that what a roller coaster on that as well. Though, I mean, that's one question we'd like to ask with that. Then, really, is do you get how have you found getting back on the horse with things like that? Do you think, you know, have you gone back and written passion projects or anything like that since and gone to get them, you know, optioned or have they been progressing to a production at all?
With Othello, I was really, really hacked off. More so with the lack of communication and the sort of sneaking around behind my back. I didn't understand what the problem was. If they'd said this screenplay doesn't work, I'd have gone, okay, why did you option it for 3 years then?
Yeah.
And then, you know, let's have a grown-up conversation. But to sort of hand it to another writer and without actually sitting down and going, can we just do this with it? And I'd have gone, yes or no, whatever. It's a conversation. And that's you know, again, we're in a business of communication. You know, telling stories is about communicating information to someone else. So I always find it extraordinary when behind the scenes, no one can communicate. No one can actually express what they want or what they don't like or whatever it might be. So, but around about the same time as the Othello debacle, the Midsummer Night's Dream project was actively growing in speed. I've been attached to it for sort of 2 years prior. But suddenly money was coming in, it was attracting great talent, and it was like, okay, cool. I can still get my Shakespeare vibe off this, I can still sort of show people I can do something other than, you know, adults holding guns and screaming at the wall. So that's cool. I was okay with that one. With Plastic, it was a terrible time actually, and getting back on the horse was not easy. It was 2013, and it was a really tricky year. There was personal things going on, like health with my close family, and that had happened. And my wife's an author, and one of her books that was supposed to be coming out got delayed by a year, which meant she didn't get paid for a year. So things were tough. You know, it was a very bad year, and getting back on the horse was tough. But what I did do was sit down and pour heart and soul into very much a passion project, which is arguably probably the best thing I've ever written. Wow. Which is, it's a big budget thing, and it's with a few of the right people at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's very personal, but at the same time, it's one of those identifiable things for any generation and any audience. So hopefully. Out of all that chaos and nastiness, something good will bloom.
Yeah.
If only that everyone that reads this particular screenplay just goes, this is amazing, and I cried, and I love the boy here, da 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 da. And you're like, okay. I needed that reaction from people that read it.
Yeah.
To tell me actually I shouldn't give up.
Yeah.
Even though I'd completely stabbed in the back, to kind of go, No. You know, this is why you're here. You are here to make my films. You are here to write. You are here to direct. You are here to turn up on set at 6:30 in the morning and get 100 people on side and make them laugh and then go, right, let's turn over then. Let's go. Action.
Yeah.
If I hadn't have written that, I'm not sure I'd have made any movies from then on, which, you know, it's basically been my life from the age of 7. So that wouldn't have been great.
Oh wow, thanks, man. Thank you so much, because that's like we covered loads and loads, and it was more than I ever could actually ask for on there, Sasha. Thank you, dude. I think one thing there is, we always like to find out, because we do recommendations as well. So you're not allowed to say your own. you can say maybe one. the one I was in. If you could recommend a film to our all of our listeners, so basically our mums, what film would you?
Oh, it'd be Calendar Girls or.
That's it. Calendar Girls, go, didn't they? You said it.
No. what are the rules of what the film,
whatever, what, I think whatever. Okay, so this week it's been things that have had inspiration with dialogue. So for me, I said Doubt with Nail, I think was another suggestion, and I've got a feeling it was another Sorkin. We were talking about Sorkin a bit. Tiernan loves The Leftovers, so he keeps crowing on about that. But if there's anything you want to recommend to us.
Well, I was going to say, if it's about screenwriting, I'd probably suggest something like The Usual Suspects, which is just so, or indeed Reservoir Dogs, which seems a bit cliched talking about Tarantino and dialogue, but Dogs was such a like dynamic force of like nature that, you know, you completely bought into the scenario, and because of the sort of the split timeline, you were just all over the place, but and yet you understood.
Yeah.
So incredibly sharp screenplay, one that I don't think he's ever bettered, even though I know people love Pulp Fiction and what have you. I don't think he's ever done anything as good as Reservoir Dogs. Mm. But in terms of dialogue, back to My God of Aaron Sorkin, I'd probably go back to A Few Good Men. It was a play originally, and yet, and quite often this is the danger of plays being turned into films. They feel very stagey and very, you know, location bound and all the rest of it. But A Few Good Men is an extraordinary adaptation of a play into a movie. And just the plotting, the characters, the structure of it, and that dialogue that, you know, actors absolutely will kill your mother for it. It's like just incredible potency to it, I think probably A Few Good Men would be my thing. And also, you know, because it's quite old now, so probably this generation, and by that obviously I mean you.
Thanks, man.
Probably may well not have seen it, or they're just kind of, oh yeah, I've heard of Tom Cruise, who's Jack Nicholson, you know, whatever.
Not. I really do hope.
Well, you'd hope not, but he hasn't obviously done anything for a while, so a whole gen probably isn't aware of his work.
Mm.
Yet, you know,
it's a great.
I Eat Breakfast 200 Yards from Cubans Who Are Trained to Kill Me. You know, just, oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Someone's actually written that, and someone like Nicholson is saying it, and it's two, again, going back to that short film thing, it's two guys sat at a table talking.
Yeah.
But boy, oh boy, is that a masterclass in two people table talking.
Wow. Thank you so much, Sasha. Thank you. That's really, really helped us, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that, Sasha. Much appreciated for your time and all your advice. And I hope you guys enjoyed that.
So I certainly did. Thank you very much.
Whee!
There's a film in that.
Interview. It's an interview.
There's a film in that.
Interview.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn if there's a film in that.